Baker. He can't have Ayers pick him up at the villa. He's savvy enough to realize at least this much, and so he plans to have her pick him up at the Trunk Bay Overlook. I don't get it, Ayers says. Why don't I just come to the house? For all he knows, Ayers has been to his father's villa with Rosie. He isn't willing to risk it. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, Baker says, but my brother Cash also has a crush on you, and I think you coming to the house to pick me up for our romantic beach date would be uncool and probably also unkind. I'll be at the Trunk Bay Overlook at 10. Baker isn't completely lying. Cash does have a thing for Ayers. When Baker comes down dressed in swim trunks and a polo shirt with a couple towels he lifted from the pool house, Cash shakes his head. I can't believe you. It's not like we're eloping. We're going to the beach. If you were eloping, you'd be breaking the law. You're married, Baker. Baker lowers his voice. He's not sure if Irene is awake yet or not. I told you, Anna left me. She's in love with Luisa Rodriguez. Do you not remember having this conversation? Were you too drunk? I remember, Cash says, but still. Still, Baker thinks, you're jealous. She doesn't know who you are, does she? Cash asks. Who we are? No, Baker says, I haven't told her. If she knew who you were, she wouldn't go out with you, Cash says. But she's going to find out sooner or later. You should cancel now to save yourself the heartache. Baker feels an uncomfortable pinch of conscience. Don't tell me what to do. Fine, Cash says. What time are you going to be home? She has a previous commitment at 3, so I'll be home around then. Previous commitment meaning another date? Cash asks. It wasn't funny last night when Baker made that joke, and it's even less funny now. She didn't say. Cash takes 2 bananas from the fruit bowl, pulls them apart, and hands one to Baker. I have an errand to run around then. Why don't you have Ayers drop you at the ferry dock at that outdoor bar, high tide? We can grab a drink and you can tell me about your date. Something about this sounds fishy. What kind of errand? Baker asks. The only kind of errand there is, Baker says. A boring one. I have to pick up something coming from the States. Hopefully money, Baker thinks. Cash was ironically named because he's the brokest SOB Baker has ever known. However, meeting Cash at the ferry dock saves him from having to give Ayers another excuse about why she can't come to the house. Okay, Baker says, I'll meet you at high tide at 3. And I'll tell you about my date. As Baker hikes up the unreasonably steep hill to the Trunk Bay lookout in the gathering heat of the morning, the trade winds, he's learned, don't kick in until the afternoon, he has second thoughts. His father is dead, and the list of questions surrounding his death is long, and nearly all of them are unanswered. On the one hand, Baker feels like he's put in a good faith effort. He's made calls, he's left messages, and he followed up with more messages. Short of hiring a private investigator, which isn't a step his mother is ready to take, he has done all he can do. On the other hand, Baker's efforts feel meager. He doesn't deserve a day at the beach. He should be at home to support Irene, whether she wants it or not. There are the additional issues of Ayers not knowing who Baker is and, as Cash so emphatically pointed out, of the pesky fact that Baker is still married to Anna and hardly in a position to jump into a new relationship. To all of this, Baker says, too damn bad, he's going anyway. It's half a day of pleasure. Cash went out on Treasure Island. He has no right to point fingers. Baker is panting by the time he reaches the lookout. He needs to get in shape. He has time to gaze down over the white crescent of Trunk Bay, backed by an elegant stretch of palm trees. He thinks about snapping a picture and sending it to Anna so she can show Floyd. Half the fun of seeing something so breathtaking is letting other people know you've seen it. But he doesn't want Anna to question his real reason for being here on St. John while she's out saving people's lives. And there's no time anyway, because at that moment, Ayers pulls up in her little green truck. Baker folds himself into the passenger side. It's small. He's chewing his knees, even when he puts the seat all the way back. "Your first ride in Eddie," Ayers says. "I'm so happy you fit. I was a little worried." He doesn't fit. He has to hunch over and his thighs are cramping. But he's so happy to be in Ayers' presence, he doesn't care.
"Eddie? That's the truck's name?"
"Short for Edith," Ayers says. "Rosie named her. She had a pet gecko named Edith when she was a kid that was this color."
"Gotcha," Baker says.
There was no room for his backpack up front, so he put it in the back, and he checks the side view nervously, expecting it to go flying out when Ayers takes the steep, twisting turns at breathtaking speed. "Don't worry," she says. "Your bag is fine. I stopped at Sam and Jack's for sandwiches. I got 3 because I wasn't sure what you liked, and I got some of their homemade potato chips and a couple of kosher dills. And I went to Our Market for smoothies." Baker looks down in the console to see 2 frosted plastic cups, 1 pink, 1 light yellow. He was too nervous to eat the banana Cash gave him, so he threw it to the iguanas on the way down the hill. But now he's both starving and dying of thirst.
"Which one is mine?" he asks.
"Take your pick," Ayers says. "There's strawberry papaya and pineapple mango." She turns up the music. It's Jack Johnson singing Upside Down, and Baker surprises himself by singing along. Until this very moment, Baker hated Jack Johnson, harbored an almost personal vendetta against him. In fact, because one of Baker's former girlfriends, a chick from Northwestern named Trinity, had loved Jack Johnson so ardently. She would only have sex with Baker if Jack Johnson were playing in the background. Needless to say, this had made Baker jealous, and because of this jealousy, he declared Jack Johnson overrated. Now, however, sitting next to Ayers, who was singing along with gleeful abandon, sometimes on key, sometimes not so much, Baker fully understands the appeal. The music is happy, undemanding, and full of sunshine. It's going to the beach music, the same way that Billie Holiday is rainy Sunday morning music and that George Thorogood is drinking at a dive bar music. Thanks to the many hours Baker spent with Trinity in bed, Baker knows all the words. He chooses the pineapple mango smoothie. It's delicious, and Baker finds a magic arrangement for his legs so that he can relax. He was right to come, he thinks. He's happy. They twist and turn and wind around until they're somehow back on the centerline road. To the right is a stunning view of the turquoise water and emerald mountains. "Coral Bay," Ayers says, fondly known as the other side of the world. They cruise down hairpin turns until they reach a stop sign, an intersection, a little town on a harbor filled with boats. "Skinny Legs is that way," Ayers says, pointing left. "Legendary. I wish I could say we'll have time to stop for a drink on the way home, but we probably won't." She turns right, and they meander past colorful clapboard cottages, a convenience store called Love City Mart, a round, open-air restaurant called the Aqua Bistro. "Best onion rings on planet Earth," Ayers says. She hits the gas and they fly up around a curve and nearly collide with 3 white donkeys standing on the side of the road.
"Donkey!"
Ayers cries, and at first Baker thinks she's as surprised to see them as he is. What are 3 donkeys doing on the side of the road? Ayers pulls to the shoulder, and the donkeys leisurely clomp over to the car. Ayers reaches across Baker, grazing his leg with her arm, which sends an electric current right to his heart,
and she pulls a withered apple from the glove box.
Do as I say, not as I do. We're not supposed to feed them.
Ayers sticks the apple out, and the alpha donkey eats it from her outstretched palm. She looks at the other two and sighs.
I wish I had three. Sorry, guys.
When they pull back onto the road, Baker says, Whose donkeys are those? Do you know them?
There's a population of wild donkeys across the island, Ayers says. I do have one favorite. I call him Van Gogh. He only has one ear, and I keep the apple for him. But I wanted you to see them up close. You haven't been to St. John until you've seen the donkeys.
She throws her hands up. She seems positively radiant, and Baker hopes it's because of him. She's wearing a crocheted white cover-up with a white bikini underneath, and her blonde hair has been wrangled into a messy bun. She is so pretty it hurts, and she keeps an apple in her glove box for a donkey with one ear. Baker can't imagine anyone being more infatuated than he is with Ayers Wilson right now. He feels a buzzing against his leg and the sound of bongo drums. It's his phone. He has to recontort himself to slide it out of his pocket. He checks the display. Anna. He hurries to silence it, then to turn the phone off completely. He'd like to chuck it out the window. When he got home the night before, he saw he had 6 missed calls from Anna, but not a single voicemail. Anna doesn't believe in voicemail. It can too easily be ignored. What's up? Baker had texted first thing that morning, but he had received no response. That was Anna's way of punishing him for not answering his phone. But Baker didn't want to talk to Anna on the phone, and now that she had confessed to falling in love with Luisa Rodriguez, Anna no longer got to say when and how they communicated.
Who was that? Ayers says.
My brother, Baker says quickly. He probably wanted to remind me that I'm meeting him at high tide around 3, or whenever we get back. I forgot to ask you, is that okay? Can you drop me at high tide?
Works for me, Ayers says.
Finally, they reach the beach, and, as promised, theirs is the only vehicle around.
Sometimes there are snorkelers, Ayers says, but hopefully not today.
In the back of her truck, she has 2 beach chairs, the picnic, and 2 pool rafts. She and Baker carry everything out onto the beach, which is a half moon of smooth blue cobblestones. Baker has never seen a stone beach like this one before. It's tricky to walk, but Ayers strides ahead sure-footed and Baker attempts to follow suit. She places the chairs down, hides the picnic in the shade of the chairs, and slips off her cover-up. It's like a veil falling off a piece of art. She picks up one of the pool rafts and heads for the water, which is a bowl of crystalline blue.
Come join me when you're ready, she says.
Oh, I'm ready, Baker says. He shucks off his polo shirt, takes off his watch, puts his phone and his watch in his backpack, rubs sunscreen on his face, hoping he got it all because there is nothing less attractive, Baker's school wives have informed him, than a lapse of personal grooming in a man. Back hair, yellow teeth, unclipped toenails, which has led Baker to become overly sensitive about how he presents himself. Anna, of course, wouldn't notice if Baker had hot dogs growing out of his ears, but now there is someone new to impress. Baker grabs a float. The water looks inviting, but there's a slight downward incline, and the rocks are difficult to negotiate, and they're burning hot besides. Baker decides to run for the water, praying he doesn't break an ankle, and then throw himself and his raft face down onto the water's surface. This works, sort of. He's in the water now, half on the raft, half off. He probably looked like a buffoon. He made a huge splash, and now there's a wake undulating through the water that reaches Ayers. She laughs.
Come over here, she says.
He paddles over to her, then flips onto his back without too much trouble. Ayers reaches for his hand. They hold hands, drifting across the surface of the bay. From here, Baker can better appreciate the beach. The stones are backed by scrub brush and the occasional palm tree, and on either side of this bay are rocky outcrops. It's silent and it's deserted. They might be the last two people on Earth. Baker closes his eyes, feels the sun warm his skin. This is delightful. He doesn't go to the beach enough. Why is that? Probably because the closest beach to Houston is Galveston with its sour brown water. Floyd loves it, of course, and clamors to go whenever there's a break from school. But that's because he doesn't know any better. Baker and Anna went to Anguilla on their honeymoon. During their first dip into Meade's Bay, Anna was stung by a jellyfish, so for the rest of the week, they hung by the resort's pool. When he and Cash were kids, Baker remembers, their family went to Jamaica. Russ had been keen to go, but this was back when he was still a corn syrup salesman, and so they had traveled on a budget. Even at 10 years old, Baker had realized this. They had stayed at a hotel not far from the airport, and for the first few days, it poured rain. Baker remembers watching television exactly as he would have done at home. His father walked out onto the balcony every time the rain abated, thinking it would clear, but it never did. Finally, Russ had broken down and given the boys each $3 for the arcade in the lobby, even though Irene believed video games corrupted children. Baker and Cash had quickly tired of the pinball and Ms. Pac-Man, and they decided to sneak out of the hotel. They darted across a busy road to a real Jamaican village, where people were selling crocheted hacky sacks and bootleg Bob Marley tapes, where people were cooking a goat on a half-barrel grill, and where a man was playing the guitar and singing in a language Baker and Cash didn't quite understand. Irene and Russ had shown up a little while later, Irene plainly frantic at first, then relieved and teary, then more furious than Baker could remember ever seeing her. When the sun came out the next day, it didn't matter. Irene stayed in the room. But Russ, not wanting the vacation to be a complete loss, had rented a car and driven the boys all the way to Dunn's River Falls. On the way home, they stopped at Laughing Water Beach. Baker remembers racing for the waves, screaming and splashing, with Russ right alongside of him, giddy as a little kid. Later, they had dried off with the threadbare towels they'd taken from the hotel and stopped at Scotchie's for jerk chicken and rice. Baker can practically see Russ, glowing from a day in the sun, throwing back a red stripe to cool the spice of the chicken. His father had been happy. His father had loved the tropics. "My father loved the tropics," Baker murmurs.
"Oh yeah?" Ayers says. "What did your father do?"
"I'm not really sure," Baker says. "He was in business." Suddenly, Baker hears a splash. He opens his eyes. Ayers has flipped off her raft into the water. Before Baker can blink, Ayers' bikini top lands on the raft, and another second later, her bikini bottoms.
"Whoa," Baker says.
"Wait a minute." She swims away, leaving Baker to grab hold of her raft and to glimpse the curves of her naked body beneath the surface. He scans the beach. No one around.
"Come back here," he says.
She floats on her back so that her breasts break the surface of the water. They're small and firm, her nipples hard. Baker is so aroused he aches. Her gorgeous, wet breasts glisten in the sun. This is happening in real life. He can't believe it, but he isn't quite sure what to do. He decides to sacrifice the rafts. He'll swim after them later. He flips off his raft, takes off his trunks underwater, and enjoys the feeling of being naked in the Caribbean. It's liberating. He belongs here. He swims after Ayers. She treads water, waiting. They kiss in the water for a while, and then Ayers reaches down to stroke Baker. The sensation of her warm hand in the cool water is almost too much to bear. He's about to pop, but no, he doesn't want it to go this way. "Let's swim back to shore," he says. He heads for the beach, hoping she's following, but once he's clambering out of the water onto the hot stones, he sees this is going to be a logistical nightmare. Why couldn't she have picked a sandy beach? Probably because sandy beaches are populated, whereas stone beaches, nearly impossible to walk on and impossible to have sex on, are unpopulated. Baker sits in one of the beach chairs and spins Ayers around to sit on his lap. She slides right down him, and the sensation is too amazing to describe. He has never more fully inhabited his body. Every cell swells with desire. Every nerve ending is shimmying. "Don't move," he whispers. He reaches forward to gently touch her breasts. He pulls her down onto him and groans. She is a goddess. He wants her to crush him, to subsume him. He wants to become her. She lifts herself an inch, then slides back down, and Baker tries to control himself, to feel the sun on his back and neck, to move his hands down to the curve of her waist. She is divine. And then, without warning, the earth shakes. It slams up to meet them, and Baker is thrown backwards. There is pain, instant and rude. The chair has broken under their weight. Ayers scrambles away, reaches for towels, tosses one to Baker. "No," he thinks. "They can't just stop." He feels nauseous. Ayers wraps herself up, her head is turned. Sure enough, another car has pulled into the small dirt lot. "You stay here," Ayers says. "I'm going to make a dash for it." She walks to the water's edge, drops her towel, and executes a shallow dive into the lapping waves. She swims for the rafts, which have drifted to the right side of the beach, out near the rocks. Meanwhile, Baker secures a towel around his waist and fixes the chair, waving to the approaching couple, who are all decked out for snorkeling. Ayers has reached the floats. He watches her put her suit back on.
"Beautiful day," the man of the new couple calls out.
Baker has never hated anyone more in his life.
"Isn't it?" he says.
Plan B. Baker and Ayers pack up and drive the short distance to Salt Pond. "The good news is we can snorkel with the turtles," Ayers says.
"Great," Baker says,
but he can't conceal his crushing disappointment. Sex. He wants sex. The 30 or 40 seconds inside of her weren't enough.
But where can they go?
Her truck isn't an option. It's way too small. Baker's spirit sags as Ayers pulls into a different sandy parking lot, this one packed with cars. "Let's snorkel first," Ayers says. "Then we'll eat." She seems unfazed by their reversal of fortune, and Baker tries to discern if this is a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe she didn't like the way it felt. Maybe the position was uncomfortable, with her feet resting on burning rocks. Maybe she was so mortified by the collapse of the chair that her way of dealing with it is just to pretend it never happened. Baker is with her on this final option. They should reset, start over. Third time's a charm. As soon as Baker gets to high tide, he's going to call Keneal and book a room. His mood improves after the short hike to Salt Pond. He has always been a reasonably good sport, able to deal with pitfalls and move on, and today will be no exception. He's carrying the chairs and his backpack. Ayers has the picnic and snorkeling gear. She has a mask, snorkel, and fins for Baker, left behind when her ex-boyfriend moved out of her apartment. Baker is such a good sport, he's going to calmly accept the fact that he's using Mick's old snorkel equipment. He's going to relish it, even.
After all, it saves him from having to rent, and the fins fit. Ayers wades into shallow water, secures her mask, and grins at Baker. Then she takes off swimming, and Baker follows. He has used a mask before in swimming pools growing up, but never in open water. They were supposed to go on a snorkeling day trip in Anguilla, but Anna had nixed it. If Cash snorkeled, then Baker can snorkel. Cash is the better skier, but Baker is a far better swimmer. He takes off after Ayers and soon is right by her side. The water is clear. The bottom is white sand covered by a carpet of seagrass. They swim a little further, and Baker expects the scenery to change. Cash describes cities of colorful coral and thousands of multicolored fish. Baker sees only sand and seagrass and Ayers's body, which is sweeter than anything Jacques Cousteau could dream up. And then he hears Ayers make a sound. She's gesticulating wildly, pointing, and Baker will be damned. A few yards ahead of them, nibbling on the seagrass, is a turtle. A real turtle, one that looks exactly like Crush from Finding Nemo. That's backwards. Crush is a cartoon, and this is nature. This is real. Floyd would... Well, his little mind would be blown. Ayers swims on, and Baker follows, waving to Crush, studying the pattern on the back of his shell, watching the way his neck stretches as he feasts on the grass. Ayers finds a second turtle, and this one has a baby turtle with him. Crush and Squirt. Floyd would love this. Ayers swims alongside the father and son turtles, and soon Baker is too. He is so close he could reach out and touch the back of the father's shell, but he's guessing that's against the rules, like feeding the donkeys. He's content to just glide along with the turtles and Ayers until the turtles dive to eat again and Ayers takes Baker's hand. They both surface. Ayers lifts her mask and says, "Cool, huh?" "So cool," he says. "I can't believe they're just hanging out."
"This is where they live," she says.
She pulls Baker in to kiss him, which makes Baker very, very happy. Then she says, "I'll race you back. I'm starving." They sit on a towel in the sun and eat their sandwiches. Turkey with arugula for Ayers, rare roast beef with barbecue sauce for Baker. And then Ayers lies back on her towel and says, "I'm going to take a nap. Then we should probably head out." Head out? Baker thinks. But she's right. It's 1:45 already. The day flew by, and now their date is almost over, so Baker will have to ask Ayers about Keneal on the way home. Tomorrow night, if she's free. Ayers lies back and closes her eyes, and Baker props himself on his elbow and watches her sleep. On the way home, Baker feels a leaden sense of melancholy. Despite the mishap with the chair, it was a great date, and he doesn't want it to end.
"Are you sure you can't go to dinner tonight?" he asks.
"Positive," she says.
"Because you have another date," Baker says. "Just tell me one thing. Is he bigger than me?"
Ayers's laugh is musical, like a bell. He loves her laugh. He loves her smooth tan arms. He loves her jangling silver bracelets. There are 5, all variations of the St. John hook, including one she had custom made with an 8 and a hook, because every February she runs a race called 8 Tough Miles, which is the length of the satanically hilly centerline road from Cruise Bay to Coral Bay. The race ends at Skinny Legs, hence the name of the bar. Things here are finally starting to click for Baker. He loves her blonde curls, her sense of adventure, her taste in music, and her enthusiasm about the natural world.
"I have another commitment," she says, "and I'm not telling you what it is, but you don't have to feel threatened."
"I do feel threatened," Baker admits. "I don't want to share you."
"Hey now," she says,
Aren't things moving a little fast?
Sorry, Baker says. I just had a really good time today. I enjoy being with you.
I had a good time too, Ayers says. But you're a tourist, so we can't get too serious. Let's just have fun while you're here, okay? Let's not attach too many feelings to this.
Baker takes this like a poison dart to the throat. No feelings? He is nothing but feelings. Let's not attach feelings, he says. Besides, I don't know when I'm leaving. I might be here for a while yet.
I guess I don't understand that, Ayers says. Do you not have a return ticket?
It's open-ended, he says.
Really?
Really.
Why did you get an open-ended ticket? I mean, I realize you don't have a traditional job, but you do have a child, right? And a life in Austin?
Houston, he says.
We had a wonderful day, Ayers says, and it was exactly what I needed. But we barely know each other. And I also don't understand why you don't want me to come to your villa. It's like you're hiding something.
You're hiding something, Baker says. You won't tell me what you're doing tonight.
Ayers takes an audible breath. My ex-boyfriend, Mick, he cheated on me. He told me he was working late training Bridget, and I went down to the beach bar at 2 a.m. and found them together. Very together. So I'm sorry, but I can't handle a man who isn't absolutely forthcoming and transparent. If you have secrets, that's fine. That's great. Good for you. But I'm not interested.
She grins at him.
I'm dead serious. I will never let myself get hurt like that again.
I would never, Baker says. Will never.
He needs to keep himself in her present, in her future. But her words make him realize that he needs to tell her about his father. It will take just one sentence. My father was Russell Steele. Baker worries she will freak out, maybe even leave him on the side of the road and drive off. The time to have told her was right at the beginning, at the memorial service when they were sitting on the branch. But the situation had been so raw then. They had been at Rosie's funeral lunch. He had been right to keep quiet. He could have told her last night on the beach. That was a missed opportunity. He doesn't want to tell her now because she hasn't quite fallen for him yet. He'll take her to Keneal Bay, he decides. He'll consummate the relationship properly. He'll make her fall in love with him, and then he'll tell her, and she'll have no choice but to process and accept the news. It might not even matter. All right, he's not naive. It will matter. But he still thinks it's best to wait. I want to take you to Keneal Bay, he says. Take you to dinner, get a room, spend the night. Would you do that with me? When's the next night you're free? Keneal? She says.
She drops the tough girl attitude and lights up.
Baker has stumbled across the magic words, apparently. I've never stayed there, though I've always wanted to. And Zozo's, the restaurant, the Osso Buco is... Wow, are you sure that's what you want to do? It's not exactly cheap.
Who cares? Baker says. It's a splurge. You're worth it. I would love to stay a night away from my mother and brother.
I would love a night with reliable air conditioning, Ayers says. Can we turn it all the way up?
All the way up, Baker says. What night are you free?
Tomorrow night, Ayers says. I work on Treasure Island tomorrow. I'll be back around 4.
I'll make a reservation, Baker says, and meet you there around 5.
I probably shouldn't go on such an extravagant date with a tourist, Ayers says, but it's too tempting to resist. And I don't have to be to La Tapa on Friday until 4, so maybe we can sleep in, get a late checkout?
Anything you want, Baker says. Breakfast in bed, midnight swim, a marathon of Adam Sandler movies.
Ayers grabs his hand. I can't believe it. Thank you.
Say no more. It's happening. Keneal Bay, tomorrow night.
At 3 o'clock, the traffic in town is at a standstill. A ferry has just unloaded, and some of the all-day charters have come in, and happy hour at Woody's is beginning, and, yeah, Cruise Bay is a blender.
"Is it okay if I just drop you here?" Ayers asks.
They're in front of a restaurant called the Doghouse Pub.
"That way I can avoid going all the way around the block. I really have to be somewhere."
"No problem," Baker says. "I'll grab my backpack when I get out, so don't drive away."
He leans over to kiss her goodbye, and the kiss goes on and on until the taxi driver behind them honks his horn. Ayers pushes Baker away. "Go," she says. "I'll see you tomorrow at 5.
"Thank you for lunch," he says.
He doesn't want to get out of the truck.
"Yeah, yeah," she says. "Go."
He hops out of the truck, grabs the backpack, blows Ayers a kiss, then blows a kiss to the disgruntled taxi driver. He is so happy that he floats around the corner and down to the ferry dock. Next to the dock is high tide. Keneal. He has to call Keneal. What if they're fully booked? It's high season, but at least it's after the holidays. They'll have a room. He'll pay whatever it takes. Baker strides into high tide, half hoping that cash is a little late. That way he can order a drink and regroup. Maybe even take care of the hotel reservation right there at the bar. But no such luck. He sees cash right away. That bushy blonde hair is impossible to miss. Baker blinks. Next to Cash is a woman who looks a little like Anna. The woman has long dark hair like Anna, but it's loose and she's wearing a lavender tank top, drinking what looks like a margarita. Not Anna. But then Cash waves and the woman turns and a wave of nausea rolls over Baker. "Run," he thinks. "Hide." He hears a familiar voice and feels a pair of small arms wrap around his legs.
"Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, we're here," the voice says.
Instinctively, Baker bends down to pick up his son. Irene. After Huck leaves, the door to Maya's room closed and locked again for the time being. Irene does the dishes, takes an Ativan, takes a second Ativan, then goes to bed. She wakes up early, very early. The sky is just beginning to pinken. She slips from bed and heads down the 80 steps to the beach. She sits on one of the orange cushioned chaises. Now at least she understands why there were 3 chaises. One for Russ, one for Rosie, one for Maya. Russ's daughter. Irene takes off her tank top and sleep shorts. She steps into the water. And then she starts to swim. She learned to swim in Clark Lake in Door County, Wisconsin, which is also where she learned to fish. The water of Clark Lake has little in common with the Caribbean, and yet the swimming clears Irene's mind, just as it used to the summer she was 16. That was the summer she witnessed her family falling apart. Her grandmother, Olga, was dying of lung cancer in the gracious old lakefront cottage where Irene had spent every summer of her life. Irene had wanted to go to bonfires with her best summer friend, Karis, and listen to Lynyrd Skynyrd and talk to Davy Longeron, who had just bought his first car, a Pontiac Firebird. Irene had wanted to ride through the back roads of Door County in Davy's Firebird more than she wanted the sun to rise in the mornings. But she was stuck in the house with her mother, Mary, and her mother's sister, Aunt Ruth. Mary and Aunt Ruth fought nonstop about who was doing more for Olga and who Olga loved better. Irene was assigned the bottom-rung jobs, emptying the bedpans and the bucket Olga coughed into, washing the soiled sheets and hanging them on the line and riding her bike 2.9 miles each way in the hot sun to the pharmacy, where Mr. Abernathy would occasionally ask Irene to spin around so he could see how big she'd gotten.
When Irene's father showed up on the weekends, they went out on the boat to fish for smallmouth bass and walleye, and he took over Irene's unpleasant tasks so that she could swim in the lake. She swam the crawl, arms pulling, legs like a propeller, breath every third stroke, alternating sides. The movement comes right back to Irene, even though it has been a while since Irene really swam. She spent nearly $100,000 on the pool in her Iowa City backyard, 40 feet long, but she only did what Russ called the French dip, into the water to her neck, and then back out in a matter of seconds. She would hold her braid up so that it didn't get wet. The chlorine gave her hair a greenish tint. There had been a time, in the mid-90s maybe, when Irene had gone to the community pool on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays to do laps, 36 laps, half a mile, in the name of physical fitness. But that lasted only a couple of months, the way those things do. Irene swims out at first, towards Joost Van Dyke, the British Virgin Islands, another country within sight. Then she finds a calm swath of water, and she starts to the east. When she catches sight of the neighboring bay, she turns around and heads back. There isn't time to think while she's swimming, except about her heart, her lungs, her eyes, which are stinging, her arms and legs. She misses her father. He was a man of few words, but he loved her. She had been named after his favorite song, "Good Night, Irene." Irene even misses her mother, though her mother had turned bitter and hard after Olga left the house on Clark Lake to Aunt Ruth. Irene's mother had never forgiven Olga or Ruth. Her last words to her sister were at Olga's funeral. Irene has often wondered why Olga made the decision to leave the house to one daughter instead of the other. Did she, in fact, love Ruth more? Or were they simply closer, the way Irene is closer to Cash, and Russ was closer to Baker? Or did Olga feel sorry for Ruth because she was single and childless, while Mary had a husband and a daughter? Maybe the house was meant to be an attempt to make up for the bad luck life had dealt Ruth. Irene, of course, will never know, just as she will never know why Russ engaged in such a tremendous deception. It's newly astonishing to Irene that as much as we know about the world, we still can't see into another person's mind or heart. Irene remembers when she introduced Russ to her parents. His ardor for Irene had been on grand display, and Irene wondered how her emotionally reserved parents would view a man who was so outspoken about his feelings. Mary, Irene recalls, had said, "That young man certainly wears his heart on his sleeve." Before the cataclysmic revelations of this past week, Irene had agreed with that statement. Russell Steele was a man who wore his heart on his sleeve. But, as it turned out, it wasn't his real heart. Russ loved Rosie. To deny this in the name of self-preservation is folly. Fine, then, Irene thinks. She can accept it, but she is allowed to be hurt and angry. And now, for the next revelation. Maya is Russ's daughter. Irene had looked at the picture on Huck's phone and she had very nearly fainted. The girl, although only 12 years old and half West Indian, was Russ. She looked exactly like him. She looked more like him than either of the boys did. That's Russ's daughter. It can't be, Huck said. It was years before. Huck had calculated back. Maya was 7 when his wife, Leanne, died, and the one thing he knew for sure was that Rosie started seeing the invisible man, Russ, after Leanne died. The other fella, Maya's father, was years before. That's Russ's daughter, Irene insisted. She showed Huck the photograph she'd found wedged under the mattress in the master bedroom, but in that photo, Russ was wearing sunglasses, and so Irene had pulled up a picture from off her phone. She had to scroll all the way back to the summer before, a picture of Russ and Irene at the magazine's annual cookout. Before handing the phone over, Irene marveled at how normal they looked. Russ with his silvering hair and his dad shorts, Irene with her braid, wearing the very same dress she had on right then. Did she remember anything peculiar about that cookout? Not one thing. The cookout was always potluck. Irene brought her corn salad with dill, toasted pine nuts and Parmesan. People raved over it. She told them the secret was just picked corn. "Go to the stand just off I-80, she said. "It's so much better than the Hy-Vee." She drank the fruity sangria that Mavis Key brought in an elaborate glass thermos with a nickel-plated spout and a cast-iron stand. Irene had gotten a little tipsy. She and Russ had danced to the bluegrass band. Irene fell asleep on the way home. It was one night of a thousand nights where she was just a regular married woman, maybe one with a grudge against the shiny, newfangled ways of Mavis Key. When Huck looked at that picture, he pressed his lips into a straight line. Irene swims until it feels like her arms might break, then she heads for shore. She staggers out of the water, wraps herself in a towel, and bends over, staring at her feet. Maya is 12, born in November. The story that Rosie told Huck is that the pirate came in on a big yacht over Valentine's weekend and stayed for 4 nights. Rosie was working as a cocktail waitress at Keneal Bay. She served the pirate and his friends. The pirate took a liking to her. Things went from there. The pirate left on Tuesday morning, never to be heard from again, according to Rosie. A month or two later, when Rosie discovered she was pregnant, this was the story she told. She had never given the man's name. Huck said that, on the birth certificate, the father's name was left blank. "I was at the hospital when Maya was born," he said. "I was there." 13 years ago next month, February. Irene squeezes her eyes shut and tries to concentrate. When had Russ taken the job with Todd Croft? 13 years ago? Irene and Russ had bumped into Todd in the lobby of the Drake Hotel in Chicago. Russ and Irene had been in the city for the Christmas party of Russ's biggest corn syrup client. So that would have been December, and Todd had called Russ up a few weeks later. Yes. Irene raises her head. Russ flew down for an interview in February. The meeting was at Todd's office, which Irene understood to be in southeastern Florida somewhere, Miami, Boca, Palm Beach. It had been over Valentine's Day, which also fell during President's Weekend. They had planned to drive up to St. Joe's, Michigan, to ski. Irene had ended up taking the boys alone. Baker met a girl and vanished. Cash took half a dozen runs with Irene the first morning, then he went off to snowboard. Irene had headed back to the hotel, wishing she were in Vail or Aspen and that she were returning to a lodge with a roaring fireplace instead of the Hampton Inn. She had wished she could get a hot stone massage instead of taking a lukewarm bath in a cramped fiberglass insert tub. She had indulged these longings because Russ was away, interviewing for a new job, a whole new career. Irene had prayed he would get an offer. She had prayed so hard. The following Tuesday or Wednesday, Russ had come home with the first of many suntans, triumphant. "They're going to give me a bonus just for signing the contract," he said. $50,000. Irene had let out an uncharacteristic whoop. Her entire view of Russ had changed in that moment because of the money. Their struggle was over. Irene could throw away the envelope stuffed with grocery store coupons in the junk drawer. She didn't have to steel herself for Russ's reaction when the Visa bill came and he saw that Irene had bought Cash a new pair of ski goggles for $55. That was what she'd been thinking of 13 years earlier. Her liberation from coupon clipping. The dread she felt every time she handed her credit card to a merchant. She hadn't asked Russ how his weekend was, where he went, what he did. She didn't ask if he'd sailed to the Virgin Islands on a yacht, met a cocktail waitress, and impregnated her. But that, apparently, is what happened. What Irene does not want is to become a slave to her rage and her jealousy. She does not want to become her mother. I will forgive them, Irene thinks once again, if it's the last thing I do. And it might be the last thing, because the burden keeps getting heavier. A daughter, a 12-year-old daughter, Maya Rose Small, in sixth grade here on St. John at the Gift Hill School. A good student, Huck said, and an entrepreneur. She's starting a bath bomb business. She's making them in tropical scents to sell to tourists. Russ had never wanted a daughter. He had been hoping for a boy both times Irene was pregnant, and both times he got his wish. The person who had wanted a daughter was Irene. Irene had wanted a daughter. She climbs back up the 80 steps, wrapped in just a towel. Her legs are so fatigued they're shaking. Both the boys are in the kitchen, but Irene walks right past them, up to her room. She had told Huck she wanted to meet the girl, Maya. Please, she'd said. He told Irene he would think about it. Give me a couple days, he said. Which Irene knows was the right answer. Airs. She pulls up in front of the Gift Hill School just as Maya is emerging. Maya sees her and breaks into a shy smile. Ayers lets go of the breath she has been holding since she pulled out of town onto the centerline road. She thought she was going to be late, late for her first sleepover with Maya, late because of some incredibly handsome, charming, and sexy tourist. But no, she is here as she said she would be. She is a reliable, steady force during this tumultuous time for Maya. Another mother, Swan Seeley is her name, Ayers has served her at the restaurant, comes over to Ayers' open window and squeezes Ayers' forearm. You're here to pick up Maya? You are such a good person. Swan's eyes shine. I asked Beau just last night, who is going to be the female influence in Maya's life? She needs one, you know. Every girl needs a positive role model, especially these days. I'm so glad it's you, Ayers. Rosie was lucky to have a friend like you. This community is lucky to have you. Ayers blinks back her emotion. Secretly, Rosie found the other mothers at Gift Hill a little too touchy-feely for her taste, although it was unfair to criticize them because they were all just so nice. They wore no makeup, bought organic produce, dressed in natural fabrics in neutral colors, volunteered at the animal shelter, lobbied for more efficient recycling, and were generally tolerant and thoughtful. Every so often, one of these mothers would show up at La Tapa and have a couple of glasses of wine and loosen up, and that was when Rosie liked them best. Swan Seeley, Ayers happens to know, even enjoys the occasional Marlboro. Thank you. There was no question. Maya is... Ayers grabs Maya's ponytail because now Maya has climbed into Edith beside her. My best girl. Well, Swan says. She's clearly overcome, and her son Colton is tugging on her arm. But Swan seems hesitant to end the conversation, and Ayers fears the question that might be coming. Have they figured out what happened? Ayers refuses to address that topic in front of Maya or at all, and so she just gives Swan a wave and backs Eddie out into the street.
Thank you for saving me, Maya says.
She pulls out her phone.
I'm tired of people asking me how I'm doing.
Ayers is astonished, maybe even a bit discomfited by how well-adjusted Maya seems. Ayers was expecting a sadder girl, possibly even a broken girl. She hopes Maya isn't burying her feelings, which will then fester and come spewing forth later in some toxic way, like lava out of a volcano. Ayers wants to ask Maya how she's doing, but then it will seem like Ayers isn't listening. Maya is sick of that question. She probably doesn't want to be seen as a 12-year-old girl whose mother just tragically died. She wants to be seen as a 12-year-old girl. Mrs. Seely was lending her support, Ayers says. She thinks I'm a positive role model in your life. Ha! That shows how little she knows. There's no response. Maya is down the rabbit hole. Ayers grabs Maya's phone away without taking her eyes off the road and says, Hey, where to? Happy hour at Woody's?
Pizza bar in Paradise, Maya says, then Scoops.
Pizza and ice cream on opposite sides of the island, Ayers says. I feel like you're taking advantage of me because you know I would do absolutely anything in the world for you. What did Huck pack you for lunch?
What do you think? Maya says.
A leftover fish sandwich on buttered Wonder Bread? Ayers says. Maya pulls a greasy paper bag from her backpack, and Ayers can smell the fish. First order of business, throwing that away. Facts, Maya says. Then she reclaims her phone, and Ayers understands what it's like to be the parent of a teenager. They pull into Pizza Bar in Paradise at 3:30, which is a time that nobody other than a sixth grader with a stinky lunch wants to eat, and so they have the place to themselves. Maya orders the margarita pizza. Why mess with perfection? She says. Ayers nearly orders the Bianco, which was Rosie's favorite. She thinks it might be a tribute of sorts, but she doesn't want to seem like she's trying to be Rosie, and besides, she isn't hungry at all. She had half an Uncle Peep turkey sandwich on the beach with a tourist. She says, Will you think I'm a bad influence if I order a glass of wine? You're my surrogate mom now, right? Maya says. Moms have wine. Perk of the job, I guess. Ayers says, trying to keep things light. She waves to the owner, Colleen, and orders a glass of the house white with a side of ice to water it down. She's keyed up, and she needs to relax. She should ask Maya about school, about things at home, about her feelings. But Maya is into her phone, which gives Ayers a few minutes of freedom to think about the tourist. Baker. Ayers rummages through the factoids. Houston, son Floyd, wife left him, brother Cash, mother here at the mysterious villa, father dead, father loved the tropics. Ayers realizes she doesn't know Baker's last name. She remembers that at the reception, he signed only Baker in the guest book. Ayers had made a joke about it. Madonna, Cher. Had Cash mentioned their last name? Ayers doesn't think so. But they'll have it in the files at the Treasure Island office. Ayers will have to remember to check tomorrow. She sips her wine, watches Maya scroll through other adolescent girls performing lip sync on Musical.ly, and tries to talk herself out of her feelings for the tourist. Yes, he's tall and super hot. Yes, he's charming and a really, really good sport. The circus act of trying to have sex on Grootpan Beach, the slapstick of the chair collapsing, that might have sapped anyone's confidence. But Baker had rebounded like a champ. And now they have a date at Keneal Bay. Ayers is embarrassed about how excited she is about this, and she issues herself a stern warning. She is not to fall in love with a tourist. And yet, an overnight date at a 5-star resort like Keneal, with a candlelit dinner at Zozo's first, and a midnight swim, and uninhibited, unimpeded hotel sex, and a breakfast in bed of percolated coffee and banana French toast, might tempt Ayers down that forbidden path. Ayers' life is so devoid of luxury and, even some days comfort, that the allure of a splurge is strong. Baker wants to treat her like a queen, and that is a powerful aphrodisiac. That, Ayers thinks, is how the pirate stole Rosie's heart, and later the Invisible Man. It's not necessarily the creature comforts themselves, it's that someone thinks you deserve them. Maya's pizza arrives, fresh and hot.
Want a slice? Maya asks.
Duh, Ayers says, because who can resist a piping hot pizza? Ayers lifts a slice, and strings of cheese stretch all the way to her paper plate. Then she feels something warm and hairy crawling around her ankles, and she shrieks and looks down. It's Gordon, Mick's dog. Ayers watches Maya's eyes widen, and she fully expects to find Mick and Bridget behind her. A split second later, the stool next to Ayers's is yanked out, and Mick sits down. He helps himself to a slice of pizza.
Hey!
Quick surveillance tells Ayers there's no Bridget.
That's Maya's.
It's okay, Maya says to Mick. You can have some.
It's okay, Mick says to Ayers. I can have some.
He chucks Maya on the arm.
How you holding up, bae?
Maya turns pink, and Ayers remembers that Maya has always been smitten with Mick. He's nowhere near as good-looking as Baker, but Mick has that something, a magnetism, a masculinity, a sly sense of humor that makes him appealing to women of all ages.
I'm okay, Maya says.
Oh yeah? Really? I'd say you're better than okay. I'd say you're the coolest young lady on the whole island.
He winks at her.
And of course, the prettiest.
Maya fist bumps him.
Facts.
This makes Mick laugh. He turns to Ayers.
Yeah, I'd say she's okay. Self-esteem fully intact.
What are you doing here? Ayers asks.
Without thinking about it, she finds herself rubbing Gordon's sweet bucket head, and he closes his eyes in ecstasy. Gordon feels about Ayers the way that Maya feels about Mick. Pure devotion.
Hangry, Mick says.
He devours the pizza in three bites and reaches over to take what's left of Ayers' slice, and she lets him.
I have to be at work in an hour.
Right, Ayers thinks. The only other people who eat at 3:30 in the afternoon is everyone in the restaurant business.
So, how was your date last night? Mick asks.
What date? Maya asks Ayers.
Friend of mine, Baker, Ayers says. We went to dinner.
I call shenanigans, Mick says. I swung by to Coalpot. You weren't there, and you hadn't been there. I asked.
We went somewhere else, Ayers says.
Where? Mick says.
Who's Baker? Maya asks. Do I know him?
You don't, Ayers says. He's visiting.
He's a tourist, Mick says.
Maya tilts her head.
I thought you didn't date tourists.
There's an exception to every rule, Ayers says.
So you're dating that guy then? Mick asks. Seriously? He looks like a banker.
Ayers throws back what's left of her wine. Oh, how she would love to order another, but she can't. She has to drive all the way across the island to Scoops and then drive home.
He's taking me to Keneal Bay tomorrow, the hotel, overnight.
Mick cocks an eyebrow.
Really? So he is a banker.
None of your business, Ayers says.
Are you jealous?
Maya asks Mick.
Do you still love Ayers?
Maya,
Ayers says.
Yes, Mick says.
He turns to Colleen and orders a pizza, the pepperoni and ham, which Ayers could have predicted. Mick is a devout carnivore.
Yes, I do still love Ayers.
Mick, stop, Ayers says.
Do you really?
Maya asks.
Yes, I do, really.
Oh, Maya says. I thought you broke up with her.
I did something wrong, and Ayers broke up with me, Mick says. I made a huge mistake and I'll regret it for the rest of my life. But just because I made that mistake doesn't mean I don't still love Ayers.
Love is messy, Maya says. My mom used to tell me that. She said love is messy and complicated and unfair.
Maya rolls her eyes.
I'll take a no thank you helping.
Mick laughs again, and Ayers asks Colleen for a box to take the rest of the pizza to go.
On that note, Ayers says, we're leaving.
Ayers, Mick says. Ayers bends down to kiss Gordon between the eyes. Then she turns to Maya.
Ready for ice cream?
Facts, Maya says.